weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to Roz and Emma for driving us through the afternoon. It is Monday, January 27th, and you're listening to Game On with me, Shane Dawson, alongside Ruby Walsh.
You're very welcome to the show. Coming up between now and 7pm, Austin O'Malley and Peter Canavan have their say on the opening weekend of the National Football League, while Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly, I'm sure Alan Cawley will have his say in the football too, reflect on the weekend's Premier League drama.
A man of many talents is our Alan. We'll also round up today's sports news headlines, and of course, as is now tradition of a Monday, Austin and the aforementioned Alan Colley will bring us some weekend sporting highlights. So if you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552, WhatsApp 0871879200, or join the conversation on X at GameOn2FM.
Game On. Check out the podcast on the RTE Radio Player app.
Good evening, Ruby Walsh.
How are you, Shane?
Very well. Very well. We are in the company already, Ruby, already of Austin and Alan Cawley, who are here nice and early. Gentlemen, how are we, Alan?
Early birds.
I'm good, Shane. You're Ruby, good. Austin, good to see you all. And I won't disappoint, Ruby. I am well prepped and ready to go with these new rules. I was watching the Sunday game last night and I won't let the cat fully out of the bag, but I enjoyed it. I'm happy with the new rules.
You're an expert. You're an expert.
Your seal of approval. The Alan Cawley seal of approval.
I gave him, if it's Morris, the thumbs up last night. I said, Eamon, you plough ahead with these rules.
Is he going to be part of the cooler backroom team next year, Austin? Or something?
I'm already part of the broader backroom team after their success.
I'm very impressed. Like, he was coming at me already with this 12v11 stuff.
We've it mastered already. The insightful analysis that's to come.
We've something conjured up here.
12v11. We have to explain there's still 15 players in the pitch, you know. No, it was a great weekend of sport, and we'll go through all of that and get our weekend sporting highlights. Ruby, you're just back from Punchestown today.
I was in Punchestown for the afternoon. Yeah, wet and windy, but some good racing, some good winners. Shane, I thought. It was good to see Maureen back on the track and winning, and she jumped really well and put up a good performance. I think the bookmakers were a little bit overreactive in slashing her for the mare's hurdle at Cheltenham. She is a good mare, but I didn't think it was that big a performance. But look, great racing, small crowd. I think the UCD and Trinity Racing Clubs were there, and they were all dressed up for it. And I was thinking, oh, do I feel sorry for ye? Ye have not dressed. Ye are not dressed for the occasion. Ye have dressed for the event, not the weather.
Am I right in saying for that, Ruby? They all dress the same. And the no socks, the young students.
Kids these days.
That's a thing nowadays, yeah. I sound ancient saying this.
I was walking out, and there was a couple of lads coming out beside me, or just kind of in front of me, and I was looking at them and thinking, like, surely to God, between the five of them, they own a jacket.
They seem to all have the same look, and they're gone mad for them. What's the cap?
The flat cap.
Yeah, they're gone mad for that, the flat cap.
Blame Peaky Blinders on that.
Yeah, Ruby, I heard your analysis of Maureen. You weren't that impressed.
I'm impressed with her per se, Alan. I think she's a very good mare, or a good mare. But it's just the reaction to it and slashing her into 3-1 favour for the mare's novice hurdle in Cheltenham. I just don't see how you could do that watching the race I watched today. She's a beautiful mare and you'd love to own her. But sorry if it came across that I wasn't impressed with her. I did like her. But I just wasn't impressed with the reaction by the bookmakers.
Okay. Do you know what I was impressed with? Now, I feel nervous because Ruby's going to have a follow-up question here because I'm slowly trying to get in my racing knowledge of...
This will be good, Shane Dawson.
Yeah. I know, it's very base level, don't you? Don't worry, Liz, it's very base level. I was just more saying, you know, of course, after teaming up for three winners at Nace yesterday, another treble for trainer Willie Mullins and jockey Paul Town and the Punches today. It's great to see that dynamic and that relationship continue to flourish, really.
He's delighted with that.
That's a statement more than a question. But no, they are. They're in flying form. They've had a brilliant weekend. And look, the season builds the whole time. But you're building into the DRF next weekend, which is an all-ticket event. I think I may have said last weekend it was sold out. It's not sold out, but there's not many left. It is an all-ticket event at Leopardstown next weekend, and you know it goes from there into the Spring Festival. So they really are hitting form at the right time of year, Shane.
Elsewhere today in terms of news headlines, obviously over the weekend, injury news surrounding Tadhg Furlong. Connacht pair Jack Ainger and Caelan Blade have linked up with the Ireland squad at their training base in Portugal as the countdown continues to Saturday's opening Six Nations Championship clash with England at the Aviva Stadium. The uncapped Ainger was called up as a replacement for front row Tadhg Furlong. Now, David Humphreys was speaking to the media about an hour ago, and Humphreys has confirmed that besides missing the match this weekend, they are hopeful this latest setback won't rule them out of the entire championship. It's certainly not as significant as it was then in reference to the injury in November, and we'd hope to see him back playing in the Six Nations. Humphreys mentioned from Ireland's Algarve training camp to the assembled press there. In Furlong's absence, Finlay Beelam looks set to win his 49th cap in the starting team this weekend against England, while Leinster's Thomas Clarkson and Connacht's uncapped Jack Ainger look to fill a spot on the bench. So at least he's not out for the tournament, Ruby.
No, and actually my sporting highlight whilst we're on rugby was Dan Sheen at the weekend. Seeing him back for Leinster in the form he's in, I think he's a huge player for Ireland, not just for this Six Nations, going forward. Such a dynamic player. I think it was brilliant to see him back in such good form at the weekend.
Very much so. Hopefully it is a successful weekend for Irish rugby. We'll be previewing all of that a little bit later on in the week. That was Ruby's sporting highlight. Austin, I'll go to you, Austin, because I feel we're only on air till 7, Alan, so I just want to preface that before I come to you. So, Austin.
And you can't go back to Cooler last week.
Yeah. No. I was very much front and centre.
When did the celebrations stop, by the way?
Have they stopped?
Come on, Austin.
That's news to me. It had to be a week. I thought that was the tradition.
Your sporting highlights. But
my sporting highlight, it's one, I suppose, from watching all the games the weekend, and I suppose it's kind of a historic weekend for the GAA in that we had obviously the new rules being embedded in, and just, you know, as someone that watched the games, I thought there was a moment, it was a bit of a wonder strike. I don't know if you've seen it, but Kieran Murtagh's strike for Roscommon, 40 metres goal, where he, you know, obviously the keeper had pushed up into that kind of 12-11 situation that's, you know, a lot of people are kind of scratching their heads over at the moment. But I just thought, in terms of the weekend that was in it, and an iconic moment for probably, you know, the landscape is shifting the GAA with the new rules and that, I just thought it was an audacious strike. It was a wonderful strike, and it was something that we probably wouldn't have seen in the old rules. So I just thought it was an iconic moment, and it kind of just sort of capped sort of maybe a new era in the GAA. So I was thinking, it almost harked back, but it wasn't obviously as important as I was thinking of the Mikey Sheehy one, where he chipped Paddy Cullen in the 78 final. But I just thought, you know, it was a big moment, on a big weekend for the game.
It always breaks my heart. Anytime there's a Dublin Kerry montage, I just, Paddy Cullen's hoping he reaches it. And he never does.
He never does. Sanchez the weekend with Chelsea.
But I thought Miola Hare's commentary to that is epic as well.
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely sensational. Sensational stuff.
You can have the floor is yours.
I have a couple, Ruby. I have a couple. I know Forrest has been the story of the season for you so far, but we did mention Bournemouth a lot, Ruby, and Areola, and doing some job, and to win 5-0 at the weekend. I think that's 11 games now they're unbeaten. They've won 7, drawn 4. They're on an unbelievable run. He's done an unbelievable job, and that was a fantastic result. And even if you check out some of the goals they scored as well in the game, I think in their last two games they've scored 9 goals away to Newcastle and then at home to Forrest, two of the two form teams in the league as well. They've had 35 shots in those games as well, so it just gives you an idea of the attacking football that they're playing and the intent they're showing in the games as well, home or away. And I think he's done an unbelievable job, especially, I suppose, what's topical at the moment is Spurs and Postecoglou cribbing and crying about injuries, yet they have 12 players. And if you see Match of the Day on Saturday night, it actually panned to the cat today. They use it as the TV studio in Bournemouth's ground, and up in the box they had 12 players in the box, and they were all the injured Bournemouth first team players.
Yeah.
And he had a load of kids on the bench. So just considering all that, and when you take it into context and the resources that he's working off a small club, it's phenomenal what he's doing. And then my big highlight, and it's probably everyone's over the weekend, was the moment with Conor Loftus scoring the penalty, and considering all that's gone on in the last few weeks and I suppose what the families have been through, I thought it was an unbelievable moment. And sometimes moments in sport just kind of take you to a different place altogether, away from the sport and the achievement. And for him to have that moment, it might be only for that moment that he gets some sort of personal solace. But for all the players and his teammates around him as well, I thought it was fabulous.
Yeah.
And it has a funny way of throwing up things like that, sport. But for him to tuck away the penalty, and I'm sure it was bittersweet, obviously, absolutely for him. But I thought it was lovely, and all his teammates and his club mates, even speaking to Austin off air here, doing it with lads that are your best pals and your best friends, nearly means even more than your county teammates. Not taken away from them, but certainly it almost means more, I think, when you're doing it with your own pals. So it was a lovely moment.
That was also my moment weekend, but it wasn't even, you kind of referenced it there, Alan, it wasn't even scoring the penalty and winning. It was the moment of when he was kind of going back and all of his teammates just went made a beeline for. And then he kind of has the moment and then takes himself down the tunnel, kind of.
And a brilliant penalty.
Oh, smashing penalty. Yeah. Smashing penalty.
Brilliant strike.
A controversial decision, I think, if that's right, for the goalkeeper, of how it came about. But the whole story, and for Cross Malina, and obviously our thoughts that everyone affected, friends, family, anyone who knew the late Roisin Crynan, who passed in tragic circumstances. So yeah, no, it was a really, really brilliant one. And that's what we've spoken about here in the last couple of Mondays when we're doing the weekend reviews, and we can have a laugh, we can have a bit of crack, but also about that importance of sport and the narratives and stories that develop from it.
Yeah, and even and on top of that, Shane, you're saying about like the referee in a controversial decision, he's probably getting a bit of stick today, which is unfortunate. Yeah. But look at the abuse Michael Oliver is getting, and there's no place whatsoever for that. Like, we'll talk about it later, and you can agree with the decision, you can disagree. I'm sure referees up and down the country get things wrong, but they don't set out to get things wrong. And the abuse that he's taken today, Michael Oliver, and I think he's probably the best referee in the league. And maybe he needed a bit of help from his VAR officials, and we can talk about it later. But just, that's a major lowlight. And social media has a lot to answer for in these instances, because he's taken a hell of... Jamie Redknapp jumped to his defence yesterday and spoke very well on it. Because there'd be no games without referees. And I'm the first to criticise a referee, and he can critique a referee without abusing him.
Yeah, great to see Redknapp step in, like someone that has obviously a big foothold in the game as well, to come in on it, like, and be so positive.
And it's hard to attract referees.
For instances like this, Shane, you know, if you're like, if the abuse he's getting today, why would you want to even get involved if you're a young lad starting off, you know?
It is a strange one. Like, it is, and I completely understand the role social media has in society. But you just wonder at times how something can be so nasty and no one is ever liable on it. No one is ever accountable for anything. How does that work in the real world? In this world,
I don't understand how, even if you're going to hide behind a pseudonym or hide behind user 14756 with a fake picture or anything, how there's still a human behind that.
Yeah. Now, that's your go to, like, straight away.
And that's that you're able to have those thoughts, or you're able to say those things, regardless if you're not, if there's going to be no ramifications, like that, just in your own head, that. I just, that mindset of that's creeping in, that's a lot more prevalent now because we're so informed and it's so easy access. You can just straight on and just press in. I understand saying things in the heat of the moment, but there's the heat of the moment and there's also then being...
There's implications for your actions, like, yeah.
A small bit anyway, you'd have to think. I understand the freedom of speech, etc. And we do live in a democracy, but there's just been nasty as well. What's the need to be nasty?
Yeah.
Where's all that come from?
Well, even on the freedom of speech thing, Ruby, you still have to be accountable for what you say. Like, it doesn't give you free rein just to say anything. Like,
yeah, that's your understanding of freedom of speech. You can't stop people from talking, but it's just the why be nasty? And sports people, like, get it and get it in the neck. Referees are getting it in the neck. But, like, what was the conversation? Like, the four of us are not going to come on here with an audience listening to us and maybe say what we wouldn't say without an audience listening to you. There's responsibility too. And on social media, you have an audience, so surely a responsibility comes with it, maybe?
No, it absolutely does. And
that's a free-for-all now, though. It's gone way over the line.
They have large audiences.
It was Havertz's wife last week.
Yeah.
You know, you can on a daily basis now, you can pick out examples.
Motherwell manager Stuart Kettlewell has quit after abuse from a section of fans. Now, I'm aware that's not social media, but the section of fans forced his family away from matches. Motherwell said, fifth in the William Hill Premiership, but some fans had turned against Kettlewell, particularly in the wake of the Scottish Cup defeat by St Johnson on January 18th and another defeat in Perth on Saturday, this time in the league. The former Ross County manager decided he's had enough.
We were over there a few weeks ago. Remember, we went on a trip to Scotland and we were at Motherwell and we met that man. He brought us into the change rooms. He was a gentleman. No, the home farm team.
I was wondering.
And he was so nice, that man. So that's terrible that he's been forced out of his job.
There's a huge difference in criticism and say, like, by the way, you're picking the wrong team, you're playing the wrong system. That's, you could say, constructive criticism or opinionated criticism. But I think when things get personal, that's when the line is crossed. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, I think
absolutely.
It's the nastiness of it, as you said before, Ruby, like, and it's not weighted, or a lot of it isn't balanced, or there's no thought put into it, you know. And I think it's just the whole social media thing in terms of the amplification of that. But I think it's probably a wider problem in society as well, when we even look maybe at the world at large in terms of even some of our leaders and, you know, how bombastic they are. And, you know, it's just off the cuff and not a lot of thought maybe put into, you know, words have weight. And you know, I think there has to be a duty of care when you deliver them.
Yeah. words have weight is absolutely the take-home message of our first opening 20-minute chat.
Go to the other one. So you're looking at the tennis the weekend. Mm. Sinner was incredible on Sunday morning, and I thought fair play to Zverev for battling back in the third set. But then you watch Djokovic walking off on Saturday.
Getting booed
and having to put up the scan to show the tear in his hamstring.
Yeah, it's a disgrace.
You kind of wonder, like, why would someone that like Djokovic, who has battled back in numerous matches, feign injury? Yeah. Why would you boo him for being injured?
And when you consider all that he's achieved in the game as well, Ruby, just as a respect alone for the likes of him, in my opinion, the greatest ever to do it. Yeah. And how many times has he won in Australia? And I know he had that issue around COVID or whatever, but he stuck to his kind of guns on that one, if you like. But then to have him booed off the court, I thought, and in fairness to Zverev, he actually came out in his defence as well. But that's just a disgrace.
Like, if he threw the racket at Zverev and poured the water all over him, by all means, boom. But, like, you know what I mean? All he did was retire.
Yeah, there's no justification.
As you said, having to put the scan up on social media.
Incredible, like, that he actually...
And he's a warrior. That's his biggest kind of strength.
Yeah. Be very difficult. Very difficult to wrap our heads around it. We're going to take a short ad break and perhaps wrap our heads around that one. Austin, you're going to stick around and chat Gaelic football with Peter Canavan. Alan, you're going to down tools for a little while. And Stephen Kelly will join the conversation.
That's what you think.
Alan Colley's only getting warmed up here in Game On 2FM. Game On. Gaelic football. Nay, you're very welcome back to Game On as we chat Gaelic football. Peter Canavan and Austin O'Malley alongside myself and Ruby. And Peter, if I come to yourself first, and I did enjoy Niall McCoy on the RT Sport website reviewing the rules over the weekend. He said, not spectacular enough to win over the sceptics and not enough of a disaster to dissuade the optimists. The GAA's new rules made a tepid enough full league debut. Would you agree with that sentiment?
Well, I'd like to think there was more positives to be taken out of the rule enhancements than negatives, to be honest. I agree, some of the games were of mediocre standard. The one I was at myself down in Salt Hill, it took a while to get going. Maybe conditions had something to do with that. Maybe the state of the pitch had something to do with that. But by and large, when I got a chance to review a lot of the games that took place over the weekend, I thought there was much more positives to be taken out of it. In particular, the fact that the tap and go of all the rule enhancements, I would say that was the one that was really well used. And the net result is that you have a much faster game as a result. And likewise, if teams or if players were to try and impede someone right away after a foul was given or stop them from taking the tap and go, there was a 50-metre penalty. And players were soon catching on to that fact that you can't really slow the game up as much as you would like to. And in a lot of cases, then product of that was a fast move and a score at the end of it. So, look, I definitely believe there's tweaking needed to it. There's no doubt about that. I wouldn't be a fan of every rule that's there, but I do believe we'll have a much better game as a result.
Austin, we've given Peter his say. It is the end of January. It is the first round. Wet pitches, blown a gale. So we're going to concentrate on the rules rather than the form. What was your take?
Yeah, no, I think like Peter, largely more positives than negatives. I thought over the course of all the games that were played, there was a lot of them. There was a lot of good fare in it, and I think obviously with the rules embedded, and there was bits and pieces obviously that need to be tidied up, and it's very hard for, I suppose, officials straight away out that and teams, because there's so many changes and things are going to go awry. But I think overall it was positive. I thought there was a lot of good quality. I thought it speeded up the game a lot. There was a lot of good transitions. I think looking at some of the stuff that's coming in, I think there was over 11 teams hit 20 points over the weekend. And like that for me is a big plus. I think the introduction of the two-pointers and that obviously comes into that as well and feeds into it. But I think overall it was positive. Peter referenced the tap and go there. I would concur with that. I think it's a brilliant addition, because we had noticed in games prior to this that there was a lot of cynical fouling around, slowing down teams that were transitioning the ball quick, even at freeze or holding on and that. So that for me was... is definitely a big one overall. So I think overall it's positive, and it gives us probably a quicker game, more 1v1 contests. But I still think there's probably one or two things that need to be looked at. The 50 meter for the penalty or whatever, or the not handing the ball back and stuff like that. I think that's, and the other one that I would say maybe after the weekend is that I would be a fan of the two-pointer, the mark, that it's from open play, that it's not a free being moved back out. I think that's a bit weighty.
Peter, you obviously watched in Salt Hill as a spectator. Did you understand every call as a fan? Obviously, it's new for players, new for refs, but it's also new for spectators. Could you keep up with what was happening?
Yeah, well, I think I was. I would need to be. Jim Gavin has asked me on the football review committee. So,
I know that, but like, do you think everybody was up to speed with it?
If I wasn't aware of it, Ruby, I wouldn't be doing my job right. But there were supporters beside us. You could hear them, you know, saying, "What was that? What was that for?" It was easy for us to take a look back at a monitor and say, "Well, there, that's why the linesman came onto the pitch, because Galway didn't have three players in their own half of the pitch." So, from a communication point of view, and signals, even, you know, when referees stopping the clock, you know, he's making the signals with the hands. I think there's a lot of things that we need to look at to say, right, to make supporters as well as players and officials and team officials, we need to let the supporters know what fouls are for and whatnot. So that's going to take a wee bit of time to bed in. But, and plus players themselves, this is a massive change to the way our game has been played. Let's be real about it. And for players to try and get used to some of, you know, in some cases with players who have been playing the game for, what, 20 years, and they're used to slowing the game down or impeding a player whenever they're fouled, they have to change that all of a sudden. You know, this business of hand back, I'm not a big fan of it, but it's there at the minute whereby you have to hand the ball back after you've fouled your opponent or whatever. That's extremely difficult for some players not to open their beak to the referee after he has blown his whistle. For a lot of them, you know, it's very difficult as well. But I think referees, the few referees that I've been chatting to, have been very appreciative of the new rules. Yes, it's given them a tougher job, but they're finding that players aren't answering back. Players aren't, you know, trying to spoil the game or delay it and causing scrimmages, you know, at different flash points. So it's making their game a bit easier. And a lot of people do give out about the penalty for descent being 50 metres. Well, that is severe, but players will soon catch on. Managers will not tolerate their players opening their mouth to a referee whenever it's going to cost their team a score. So the net result will be it's actually making the job of the referee a bit easier, believe it or not.
Speaking of referees, we can hear from David Caldrick, who was speaking to Darren Farrell. He wasn't there in an official capacity. He was there as a spectator at the match over the weekend.
From an official's perspective, I think, you know, you've seen everything here today, all of the various FRC enhancements in practice, which from a refereeing perspective is actually a lot to take in, a lot to think about, and just being clear as to, you know, what the actual penalties are for various offences, because they're not all the same. But I think Niall and the crew did very, very well today.
For me, watching on, I don't know how they kept track of it, because we struggled here as commentators working the match. I think the crowd talking to them at halftime, they were struggling to kind of keep up to speed with everything that was going on. How did the officials do that? I did a really good job.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, I suppose to be fair to the national panel of referees, like, we have done a lot of homework, a lot of pre-training on the rules, but with Jim Gavin and the FRC, and even up to last Friday night, we did a session ourselves. The full panel for an hour and a half, like, you know, just talking through various scenarios and making sure, or trying to make sure, that we were consistent in our interpretation of some of the rules that maybe aren't fully clear. So we were well ready for it, but there's still, you know, a long way to go.
Well, what do you think will be the biggest challenge for you after watching today? But you're also at a game last night as well, weren't you?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I think the 3v3 is the big one. Now, from a refereeing perspective, you can't really police it yourself, so you are depending on your linesmen, and that's the way it happened.
Greater teamwork.
At intercounty, that's fine. Like, I mean, we do have a full team. You know, the 3v3 at club level, that's going to be very, very difficult.
Very difficult, I think, is an understatement, perhaps, Austin, about this is going to be a completely different ball game to I was going to say police, to referee and to officiate for club matches. But just on the intercounty side of things for the moment, continuing the conversation of how it's being oversaw and people are adapting to this whole new game that it is, and it can still have room for change, and we're all aware of that, that perhaps at the end of the league campaign we'll find a middle ground, that there will be a lot of tinkering.
Yeah.
It's I suppose with the 12v11 as well is something that, I mean, you're looking at individual rules. For example, say take the 12v11 of how you might tinker that or how you might change it, because some teams will benefit, others won't. But it's the same with teams are good at some things that other teams aren't.
Yeah, look, teams and coaches will, like, I suppose it's throwing it back out to them to innovate and get creative around how they're going to solve these problems. And that's, I suppose, where, you know, your the quality of coaching will come in, because there's always ways around, no matter what's presented to you, whether it's a rule book or whether it's a system that you come up against. You have to be creative and innovative as a coach. And we've seen that there. I suppose the big one where a lot of people are saying about the 12v11, where it, you know, it's giving you those kind of slow phases again where the keeper is involved and it's, you're recycling ball maybe from sort of east to west, back and across the pitch. But like we spoke about it maybe off air, and like, you know, a conundrum that a lot of teams are facing is that 12v11, but there's an opportunity there perhaps for an opposition to release their own keeper to tag a man in front of them and push someone up on the keeper, and all of a sudden it becomes 12v12 and you still have the ball out in front of you. So that, you know, it's not a, your goal is left open, but it's not a major threat. And then obviously if there's a line break through the centre, well, you can obviously, you know, you not that you're saying a cynical foul, but you can obviously get a press on whoever. But I think it's down to the coaches have to innovate and find solutions to these things, and I'm sure they will as they begin to analyse games and see where the dangers are and see where they can win those moments.
Mm. Sticking on that 12v11, Peter, just in terms of tactical innovations, we've seen over the weekend, wasn't it, Armagh changed their goalkeeper. I think Down brought on or pushed an outfielder as their goalkeeper as well. Made a decent save, but I think, with his leg. But that it's, keepers aren't going to get caught out all the time, and that it's, I suppose it's the one that I'm hearing most about. Would you agree with that sentiment?
Yeah, there's been a bit of debate about that today. Okay. There is a certain degree of jeopardy, of course, whenever your goalkeeper comes out. And we did witness that yesterday, whereby Roscommon turned down over a long kick pass and another kick on the balls in the back of the net. So some teams are reluctant to do that. Whenever teams do, if they have a good player, you know, as Austin says, it's up to the opposition to deal with it. And there's different means in which they can do that. In terms of scenarios, if it does become a problem, then, you know, it's up to the FRC to look at alternatives to that. And, you know, there's always ways to try and counteract that if it does become a problem, be it an attacking team, once they cross the 45, then they can't come back again. The other option is that if the goalkeeper does go over the halfway line and does create, and it's 12v12, it's not really 12v11, there's still 12 players in defence, but if he does, there could be an option of one of the three attackers up front, you know, chasing back, you know, to man mark the goalkeeper, and then, you know, to prevent him from becoming a spare man. So look, there is other alternatives to be looked at, but again, I don't think any major change is going to be made after one weekend of football. I think it does deserve 3 or 4 weeks. Let it bed in. Let's see how teams adapt. And then if there's major tweaking to be needed, it can be done then before championship.
You're nodding your head in agreement, Dusty.
Yeah, I think Peter's spot on. Like, it's going to take a number of weeks, particularly, you know, for, I suppose the big one is to look at whatever data is coming in, but also to establish trends and to see what the trends are showing, and then probably to go into maybe conclaves with the refs will be a huge part of this as well, I'd say, you know, because they're such an important part of the game, that what's the feedback coming from them, what are they finding really hard to police, what's tough out there, so to get all the data, I think, get all the trends, have a good solid block of stuff that you can analyse, and then, you know, I fully trust the guys that are there. There's an awful lot of capability and know-how and experience, some more now that Peter's involved. So
considering, Austin, there was such drastic changes in such a short period of time,
yeah,
And for it to go into, I know they've had their trial games, but to go into one weekend, I think it went absolutely brilliantly. And he'll always have a couple of little tweaks, but just as an observation, as a fan tuning in, watching the games, it almost felt like Gaelic football again. You had fellas contesting balls out in the middle of the field, a skill of the game. You had 1v1 battles where can the forward take on the defender? Can he get a shot off? Can he score? You had fellas shooting from 40 yards out. Something we haven't seen in Gaelic in such a long time. So I think the one thing, and even in my own sport in soccer, the easiest thing in any sport like that is to be destructive and set up defensive and get loads of men behind the ball. But the real good coaches and the real kind of people who are thinking outside the box are the ones that can come up with the solutions to form attacks and to create chances and score goals, which is what the game is all about. And I think that will really enhance the game going forward because of all those things we've seen, the high scoring games, what people want to see, entertainment. So I think, and listening to yourself and Peter, like I, who were all in favour of it, I think it was absolutely brilliant, I really do. And I was so critical. Gaelic football was on its knees, in my view, in the last few years. But watching it over the weekend, I think it's going to enhance it, especially when you get into the summer, the good pitches as well. Fellas more fitter, more in tune with the rules. The 12v12 thing you were thinking of, that'll happen. Someone might release out onto the likes of Niall Morgan, who's almost like Trent Alexander playing Gaelic. Like he really is, though. So you need to get, you can't allow him time and space. So all these things will evolve. But I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, I know. I think looking in, like, and it was just probably a real freshness to it. And I think as a coach or as a manager, like, you want challenges, and like I think it has just maybe brought the whole thing on again now, where you have to sit down and you have to really think about it. I think the game had got to a certain stage, and there was a lot of, to be honest with you, I thought there was a lot of same teams were setting up the same. We'll stack 12-14, we'll shift, we'll wait.
Whereas which is kind of easy.
Yeah, it is. It's to a point, it is. If you want to go that route, it is. And I just think there's probably a little bit more in this. And it's new and it's fresh, and it's coaches are going to have to probably step up to it and find ways. And so it's exciting. Yeah.
Peter, was that the general vibe leaving South Hill as well? This was fresh, this was new, this was entertaining?
Yeah, by and large, I think it was, Ruby. You know, you do have to bear in mind the time of year. This, it's the last weekend in January, bitterly cold. For players and supporters, but by and large, I do believe a lot of football people who chanted down there could see the merits, could see the benefit in it. And look, you definitely don't want to go back. We're not going back to the stage where you had 15, you know, players back in your own half, teams conceding kickouts, short kickouts, a lot of lateral passing. It's not going to go back to that. It is going to be a different game. And you know, I definitely agree with the fact that once the weather gets better and the ground gets firmer, we'll definitely have a better spectacle.
Yeah.
I think we'd all agree on that. When you can make football entertaining in this weather, it'll only get better in the summer.
Very much so. And you haven't even seen Kerry or Donegal yet, and how they're going to adapt to the rules. And the match that Peter was at, sure, was the storm out west in Salt Hill wasn't ideal playing conditions, to say the least, never mind the time of year anyway. But listen, gentlemen, we'll leave the conversation there for now. Peter Canavan, thank you so much for taking the call. Austin O'Malley, thank you so much for popping into studio. We're taking a short ad break, and then we're going to turn our attention to Association Football and chat Premier League with Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly.
Game on.
Football.
Welcome back to Game On, where we are going to turn our attention to soccer, seeing as we've already spoken about football. Stephen Kelly joins us on the line. Alan Cawley, I'm sure, is still in the studio. Stephen Kelly, have you put your hat in the ring for the new job at Spurs?
Oh, God, I think I have to at this stage. It's just, it's so hard, isn't it? Like, the joke, isn't it, Dr. Tottenham, if you need to get a cure, come to Tottenham because we'll sort your woes out. It's like now it's Mr. Tottenham because I think they're just so good at it, at giving teams a lift. It's unbelievable to lose to Leicester at home. It's beyond words. And, you know, we can go on about injuries and everything that they have and all they've dealt with. But if you can't put a team out at home with what you have to beat Leicester, you're struggling. And I think to think that you've lost the same amount of games as Ipswich, you are sitting second from bottom, kind of says it all at the moment. So I think I'm falling into the Cawley camp of and might have to go.
I'm
sorry, there was no bite last week from Alan Cawley.
The other side of the coin is now, Alan, he's still in plenty of competitions, and if he were to win a cup with Spurs, they don't have many trophies down that part of London.
Well, they don't, Ruby, and it's been 16 managers, 24 years and one League Cup is all they have. So in the last under Daniel Levy. So that's why he's coming under fire as well, Daniel Levy. And they're beginning to really get on his case. And the owners, when you think they're the ninth richest club in the world, Ruby, but yet their turnover only equates to 42% going on wages. Whereas you look at the likes of Man City, Liverpool, I think it's up in 56, up to 60. So they're signing the elite level players to take them to the next level. Spurs can compete with these clubs, but he just won't give the wages, Levy. And that's why he's known as such a shrewd operator. But now the fans are growing tired of this. They're charging a fortune to get into games, and the fans are growing tired of it. But I still think that's all fine and good and well, and he can point to all those examples. But when the manager puts the players out in the pitch like he did yesterday against Leicester, who have lost seven games in a row, they've only scored two goals in those seven games. And you go back to Everton last week, who had only scored 15 goals in 22 games, and yet they scored three in 45 minutes. That's on the manager, Ruby. That's nothing to do with the owner. And when you look at even the analysis that we're doing on Match of the Day last night, and we go through it every week, how open they are in that centre midfield area, that's a damning indictment to Postecoglou. And him coming out saying, it's who we are, mate, we won't change, we have injuries, it'll get better, it's absolute nonsense. And you can only have to point to Bournemouth and the job Iriola's doing with the amount of injuries he has, yet he's a manager who can set a team up properly regardless of injuries. And that's the difference. So I think he's done, I think he's finished. You're right about that. He's in with a chance of maybe winning the cup, and I think that's the only thing that's hanging him in. But can you see them beating Liverpool, the Aston Villa in the FA Cup? So it's his own fault, Ruby, I think he's way out of his depth.
No one can possibly think they're going to Anfield to beat Liverpool away from home. Not like that's not a competition they're in. I don't see that as even being feasible. The Europa, they have more chance to win the Europa League than they do go to Anfield and win that game.
He can't set the team up, and that's the problem. Look how open they are.
Where should Spurs be in the table if, like, when you look at the playing group, or is that too of a simplistic question, Stephen? Because it's so dependent on a manager.
No, it's not really, because if you look at the players at their disposal and you still think of what they have, if they have a fully fit team, yeah, listen, injuries will come into it to some extent, but that will only account for so much of the games they've lost. They've lost so many games from winning positions with those players on the pitch as well, which is just, you can't legislate for as a team. And Tottenham, they got to be pushing for Champions League position. That's where they have to be, I think, for Tottenham to be successful. European competitions would be a must. So you're saying top six, and if they're pushing for Champions League, that's where they should be, with the likes of Son and Kulusevski and Solanke. And I know there's a lot of players in here, Madison, even Bentancur, middle of the park, the young players, Bergvall and Gray, they've been two of their better players. And to be honest, I think Gray, if you put him into centre midfield and actually sit him in front of that back four, he'd do a much better job than sticking him out of position. Now, you have Reguilón on the bench. Listen, he's by no means a wonderful left back and gone on to like light things up, but you're playing a natural player in a natural position, and then you put your guy that you can play midfield in front. So things have been done that you just shake your head and go, I don't understand the concept of what they're trying to achieve here.
Alan, when did the 11 lads walking onto the pitch think this isn't working and we'll just get a bit tighter?
Mutiny. It's at the stage as well, Ruby, where it's there's so many examples of it, and this isn't us kind of jumping the gun here tonight because they lost to Leicester. Like, how long have we been saying this? And it took me until last week to finally say, look, he's out of his depth. So you have to look at patterns and examples, and they're conceding goals hand over fist. Like, and he keeps pointing to injuries. But even if you have injuries, that might be all the more reason to maybe kind of be a bit more condensed and shut up shop a little bit. And so, not shut up shop, you can still play your attacking football, but out of possession, you have to have a plan. I never see ever a plan out of possession. They are so wide open, it's incredible. He gives no respect to the opposition, absolutely zero respect to the opposition, which is something every manager in the world has to do. You have to respect your opposition no matter what level you're playing at, because especially now in the Premier League, they're so well coached, every team, even teams down near the bottom, can cause you problems. So he's just, and then it's his kind of, he's almost antagonising people, I find now in the interviews afterwards as well, and because he's so brazen and so stubborn and naive at times as well, but because he's so brazen and so stubborn that he won't change, he's shooting himself in the foot, because it can only end one way. And it's going to end the way we all can see right now at this moment in time.
Stephen, does it make it worse? And I suppose bringing the conversation on, when then you look at Iriola defying the numbers at Bournemouth, Forest doing well under Santo, and they're kind of run at the moment as well. I know Alan spoke at the top of the show about how Bournemouth were depleted of numbers, yet they still put in big performances, nine goals in their last two matches. That kind of really emphasises that there's other managers in the Premier League that are really overachieving.
Yeah, like I think when you look at Bournemouth, you look at Brighton, you look at Brentford, all those teams, three Bs that are just better than Tottenham at the moment, better in every aspect of it in the way they go about their business. But then, like, West Ham, a rival to Tottenham, who sacked the manager, have jumped ahead of them in the table by 3 points. And West Ham are dire. Like, you look at West Ham, and no one would say West Ham were played well this season. Everything. West Ham are struggling. They're cannon for the potential relegation. And Tottenham are below them now on the table. So you're going, it's just, it's unthinkable. And I think the point you come to as well is we're going to spend the whole show talking about Spurs, but how the players in the pitch don't just go, listen, I understand what you're saying, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do what I think is best in this moment in time because what you've said is not working. And listen, Colly, we've fallen out, managers. You do every now and again, but if you get the result, they don't care.
Mm.
That's a major problem. There's no leaders. Like,
yeah.
Is it?
Speaking of a team that was accused of having no leaders, Manchester United are continuing to build a fragile sense of belief, Alan.
Stop, Shane. Did you watch the match? It was the worst game of football I've ever seen in my life. It was absolutely horrendous. It was so poor. And I was so disappointed with Fulham, who were having a really good season, Marco Silva. But honestly, I sat down last night thinking 7 o'clock on a Sunday evening, good time for a game.
But Al, in all fairness, how could you play at 7 o'clock on a Sunday?
Ruby, well, you're always critical of how pampered these fellas are. You should be able to play at any time. But it was dreadful. Now, he'll be delighted, Amrin, but like, you think Spurs have problems. Man United have every bit as much problems. But then I suppose the most damning thing to come out of that last night was his comments about Rashford. So Rashford must be so poor as a professional when he's coming out saying he played a 63-year-old goalkeeper ahead of him that he's literally not lifting a leg.
Goalkeeper coach.
I think that's really damning for Rashford going forward, Shane, because if people are questioning your professionalism in the manner that he did last night, Amrin, and I liked how forceful he was in coming out saying it, that's not a good reflection whatsoever on Rashford.
Do the public comments have to stop, Stephen, or is, like, when we get to a level of, okay, this is probably at a stage where it's not going to be mended, and I know he maybe used it as a tactic initially to try and put of encourage him in a way with that constructive criticism, but at this point it's like, can we just deal with it in-house and kind of move on, because it's going to affect then Manchester United on the broader scale.
Yeah, well, I think from the board he might be getting a little bit, because you're damaging your asset for an answer. You're trying to sell him on, so from a wider perspective the board might be going, listen, you understand, you're frustrated, you want him to play, but you know, if you can't be keep hammering him from in public, because we want to get rid of this guy and we have to try and get something back from him. So that might be an issue. But as far as the manager's concerned, I think he's gone in there and he's been told by the powers to be, you're in charge and you deal with the players as you see how he is fit. And he obviously hasn't thought they're good enough. And I think up until he gets his own players in the door, until he has a bit of a run at it, he can kind of criticise what's there because they're not technically his players, if you know what I mean. He can kind of throw them under a bus a little bit and then see if they give him a reaction. If they come back and play from, or else they throw the toys out of pram and they soak off, which is what's happening at the moment, I think, with a lot of them.
Arsenal dug out a result against Wolves, but City are on the way back, Al.
Are they?
They are. So 3 weeks ago, they'd lay down. They should have been 2 down anyway. Palmer's pass was poor. They should have been 2 down, but they'd lay down 3 weeks ago.
No. Well, I think a couple of new signings. I know the lad Kushinov had a little bit of a tough time, but I think he'll be a good signing. Marmoush obviously came in as well. So they needed that injection of kind of energy and youth almost into the squad. I still would have question marks about them, Ruby. I watched them against PSG last week and they were, again, out of possession. It's the problem because they just don't have the legs and the energy. But yeah, they were a bit better. Now Chelsea helped them, the goalkeeper as well. I'm not sure what he's doing. Everyone's critical of him, and rightly so for a reason. I'm not sure where he was going, Sanchez. But the strange thing about that, if you look back at the goal, and you're a goalkeeper, Shane, initially,
very much not at the level of you or Stephen.
Well, you wouldn't
football.
Have done this, because initially he runs out and obviously feels like he's hesitated massively, makes a mistake. But instead of actually going back to the goal because the defender's in front of him, he stands in the same position. And Haaland just lobs him. So I thought it was crazy, but he's a problem. But yeah, it was a good win for the Marubi, but I'd still have me reservations about Arda back.
I think brain freeze, mental fragility.
He caused the goal last week. They got away with it now against Wolves. He's a problem, the
That's
goalkeeper.
When it gets
yeah.
into your head, then, like, it's for goalkeepers.
He thought he was a sweeper. That's all. That's all that happened. Yeah. Alan, or Stephen, sorry. Do you think Southampton could manage to get by Derby's score of 11 points in the league?
5 points they need from, 15 games left?
considering they've only six from 23.
I don't know. Honestly, I think I played against that Derby team and they were woeful. Like, I mean, they were absolutely dreadful. And I think I actually think they took a point off us, which is even worse. But
did the goal, come down the right side, Stephen?
Yeah, definitely did. Yeah, no, but yeah, they. I actually don't know. I think they're so bad. They're so bad, and they haven't learned. You think maybe they're going to be a bit more solid defensively, going to look like a shape, get a five midfield, pack it out, stop. But they're still playing good. It's like they've just been taught how to play. And I'm looking at the players. Like, I know they got an England cap. Harold Bellis, I know Roy Keane. I'm going, how did he get an England cap defending the way they defend? I'm looking, am I seeing something different here?
I don't know, beggar's belief. Alan, are you seeing something different? You're the expert here, don't be.
53 goals, yeah. No, I don't think they will get 11.
No.
I don't think they will.
No, not ideal. The other end of the table, let's be positive, gentlemen. How impressed were you over the weekend, Stephen, with Liverpool's performance? Or was it a case of they're up against a very below average performance from Kieran McKenna's side?
Yeah, I think getting the early goal, McKenna seemed out. They just went down. That was it. But I just, the way Liverpool score goals, the quality of it, like they hit the post, they hit the bar, the delivery into the box for two or three, the crossing in, you're just going, it's so nice to watch. And then they flood the bodies forward. When you see the score goals, it's three or four bodies in the box every time. That's what I'm looking at Tottenham thinking, no chance when you go to Anfield. The way they play, how quick they go through the lines. And then, yeah, they gave a goal away, but they're just, I think they're Champions League. I don't think they're getting stopped.
They're so impressive, yeah. One thing that I took away from the weekend, even on the Liverpool thing, was the one thing he spoke about on top of the quality slot, but the work rate. And it just goes to show you, like, you're talking about players there, Man United going through the motion, Spurs. You look at the work rate of those Liverpool players, and all the best teams have that as well, Shane. Everyone focuses on the technical ability, and rightly so, because they're so good. And it almost gets overlooked, but they're working as hard as anyone. And that's the one thing he emphasised. But I think it was a big win for Arsenal as well. When you look at the sending off, I think he made a howler, Michael Oliver.
Yeah.
He doesn't deserve the abuse he's getting, but I definitely think it was the wrong call. He's trying to stop a counter-attack, Lewis Skelly. He does, and it's like everything, and this is the problem with VAR. When you do slow it down, of course he kind of grazes over his ankle or whatever with his studs, but he's just trying to trip him and stop the counter-attack. That's where I think VAR, and this is a problem with VAR, and maybe because Michael Oliver is the most high profile and the best referee, that the VAR never want to undermine the referee. But I think they should be in his ear saying, you know what, Michael, maybe have a look at this again. I'm not sure if it is a red, but they were just happy to go along with his decision. I think they could have helped him out in that situation. But considering Arsenal were down to 10 men for so long, that's a massive, massive win.
It wasn't a great weekend for VAR, Stephen, with that incident included.
No, it wasn't. Yeah, it's weird. You're watching the back and you slow it down, the studs catch him, but like, it's a trip. He's not tried to stud him. He's tried to just stop him from going. But again, sometimes, genuinely, listen, this shouldn't have been a sending off, absolutely. But sometimes when I see those such blatant fouls, I'm like, how do you stop them from the game? I said, it may be a red card is how you stop it, but it wasn't one in that instance, even though I'd love for Arsenal to get red cards. It definitely wasn't one.
No love lost there anyway. Everton, David Moyes, 1-0 against Brighton. Good result for them.
Yeah, brilliant manager, Ruby Moyes. I'm delighted as well. And look at the bounces after getting in. Spurs will be looking over her shoulder if they weren't already. There's Leicester getting the win. I don't know, will they close the gap? But certainly Everton are going to overtake Spurs very, very soon. They have a game in hand. I think that's against Liverpool. That'll be a tough one. But they're only a point behind now. And I'm delighted for Moyes. One of the good guys of football. There's not many of them, but he's one of the good guys. Done an unbelievable job over the years. Got a raw deal at Man United. And to see him kind of have the career that he's having since, because that could have really hampered him. And again, you look at West Ham getting rid of him as well. I thought it was a strange decision, but I think Everton will reap the rewards of that and going into the new stadium. It's great to see them doing well.
Well, our producer John Farrell will love that, the fact we're going to have to end on that note, because we've just run out of time, unfortunately. So I think you may have planned that.
Come on, Everton.
Stephen Kelly, thank you very much for joining us. Alan Colley, pleasure as always.
Thanks, lad.
That is all we have time for. Myself and Ruby will be back tomorrow from 6 o'clock. A big thanks to John Farrell and Laurie Davis working on this evening's show. The new music show with Beto da Silva is up next, but from all of the Game On team for now, it is bye-bye.